Hello and welcome to the Investors Chronicle Companies and Markets Show. I am John Heumann, editor of the Investors Chronicle. This week I am joined by Ian Smith, deputy companies editor.
How are you doing, John? All right?
I'm all right. How are you?
Yeah, not too bad.
Good.
Thank you.
Theron Mohammed.
Hello.
How are you,
Theron? Glad to be here.
Well, of course you are. It's the best place to be. Over in the control room, we have Mark Robinson. Mark, how are you?
Very well, John.
Wonderful. And Dom on the controls. How are you, Dom?
Very well, thanks.
Good. And in a bit, he hasn't turned up yet, which is very typical of him. But Algie Hall. Oh, no, here he is.
The late Algernon Hall.
Here he is. We're going to lock him out for a bit and he can come in a minute. That will teach him for being late. But Algie's going to come in and talk stock screens with us in a minute. But in the meantime, let's talk news. Ian, what's going on in the news this week?
Good question. Well, the big FT related news that we just broke as we were coming on air today was that the German publishing group, Axel Springer, is in advanced discussions to buy FT Group, which contains Investors Chronicle.
Exciting stuff. Exciting stuff. I mean, I'd be more excited if I hadn't heard it a million times before. But I mean, these reports do feel a little bit more concrete than anything we've heard before. The fact they're being reported in the FT is quite extraordinary.
Yeah, it's exactly right. I mean, yeah, for a few years now, Bloomberg to buy the FT.
Sorry, There's been a late development. Newsflash here. Nikkei Borders for 1.29 billion.
Sorry, are you joking?
Oh, this is the note's been handed to me, John.
Here we go. We've got literally breaking news.
This is
incredible.
So exciting.
The news has come from Algernon Hall, though, so the veracity is open to question.
Well, let's check that out in a minute. Algie, keep watching your phone over the next few minutes to verify this this story. Exciting stuff.
Exciting
so
stuff.
It's not actually Springer at all.
That's so much good prepared stuff to say as well. There we go.
Wow.
Such is the nature of news.
Yeah. Well, so we're turning Japanese. amazing. Right, anyway, we're not actually allowed to give a view on Pearson. It's one of yours, actually.
Yep.
Theron, it's one of yours. We never give a view on Pearson for
we
the obvious reason.
We might be able to soon, though.
But we might be able to soon, which will be fun. Yeah. Okay, what else is going on?
We had some slightly disappointed third quarter figures from Apple, which sent its share price and market cap down, Theron can give us a great view on.
Tell us about that, because I mean, this was big news, big tech fallout in the US, took the markets down with it. 60 billion off, 66 billion, I think the quote figure was, off Apple's market cap. But the figures didn't look that bad to me.
Yeah, I mean, I think Apple just fell victim to extremely high expectations that it was inevitably going to disappoint at one point, because expectations just keep going through the roof.
Mm.
And looking at the figures, they sold nearly 48 million iPhones, more than a third than the same quarter last year. So it's nothing to be sniffed at. But they didn't manage to meet the more bullish estimates.
Yeah, but I mean, these are broker estimates that, you know, they're not coming from Apple itself. So, you know, this is the street getting ahead of itself a bit, perhaps.
Yeah, I think people tend to buy into the idea that Apple can do no wrong. And sometimes it just slips up relative to what people expect of it.
Were there some question marks over the amount of sales of the Apple Watch? Because that's something that Apple haven't told the market, right?
Yeah, so the guesstimates that people have is they've made about $1 billion in revenue from it, which is, again, not too bad.
That's shocking. Just a billion?
And on the product front, it seems like everything is going well to sell that many iPhones, considering that people are getting to the point in the year when they're going to start waiting for the next one to come out.
The new iPhone is, I mean, I'm not a gadget freak, but the new iPhone is magnificent.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a magnificent product. I've got an old one and it's, you know, I mean, even I am thinking, "Whoa, this new one's great. It's big. It does, you know, things that this thing can't." I mean, it is an incredible product.
Yeah.
And, you know, Samsung, so when Apple went through its last hiccup in terms of the share price, and there were question marks over its growth, question marks over Tim Cook, and big concerns that Samsung was coming along to it. Samsung has fallen by the wayside.
Yeah, completely. And I think what investors can look to is that the Apple Watch will get better every year, just as the iPhone did. The first iPhone wasn't particularly great. And Apple's management even said that the Apple Watch has done better in its first few months of trading than even the original iPhone or iPad did. So it's a success by a lot of measures.
So we've had these shares on a buy for a long time, ever since I tipped them. What in today's prices was $50-odd?
Yeah, $52, I think. And so now it's $125. So
profit on that.
No problem. No problem. Send the checks in the post to 1 Southwark Bridge for the attention of John Heumann. Cash. we're not worried. Perhaps we see this as an opportunity to top up a little bit more?
Yeah, on the valuation front, it still looks incredibly cheap, and it's seems to be firing on all cylinders. So I'd say this is a buying opportunity.
Okay, that's interesting. Well, I mean, let's turn to one of the results you wrote this week, which is, in fact, there were two results that are Apple related. One was ARM, the chip designer. Yeah. Get that right. Which obviously powers a lot of the world's smartphones, including Apple phones. They did okay, but shares came off a little bit. There were some elements to that result that weren't quite what the market was expecting.
Yeah.
So what do we think about that?
Well, on the licensing side, basically ARM licenses out microchip designs to Apple and Samsung, then collects a royalty every time those companies ship a phone to their stores with one of its chips inside. So there are two aspects of licensing revenue and the royalty revenue. And the licensing revenue was a bit below expectations, which is why the shares fell.
We're not worried about this?
Yep. As we mentioned earlier, with the momentum of Apple's iPhone and the fact that ARM reports royalties one quarter in arrears.
Exactly.
If Apple sells a lot of iPhones this quarter, ARM, when it reports next quarter, is going to have a good quarter.
And in terms of licensing, which is where the softness was in the last results statement, they themselves have said that they expect that to accelerate a little bit. And ARM chips seem to be going into a lot more sort of new types of products, you know, things that it perhaps wouldn't have been in before, beyond the smartphone, beyond the iPad type stuff.
Yeah, so there are two sides to that. So ARM's management has said that they expect a new raft of smartphones this year that include their higher margin, newer chips, so a higher royalty per chip. And also ARM is a big world leader in the Internet of Things, getting microchips into all these connected devices, whether it's in transport or telematics in a car or healthcare or energy, all these different markets.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's interesting. I mean, we've got them on hold. Which I guess is a rating thing, as much as anything. ARM has always been extremely highly rated.
30 times for earnings.
Yeah. So. But still a great company and potential buying opportunities there if the share price falls back anymore.
Yeah.
The other company that's obviously very, very much gadget related is Dixon's Carphone.
Yeah.
And that was a merger of Dixon's. Or what did they call it? What did they used to call it?
Was it Dixon's?
Changed his name every 5 minutes.
It
was DSG for a while.
Yeah, yeah.
Obviously owns Currys. So yeah, Dixon's Carphone and it merged with Carphone Warehouse. And
there were many critics of the merger, and those critics have been confounded on these numbers.
Not us.
Not
we
us.
Had it on a buy. This looked like an amazing deal to us. Incredible synergies.
And the synergies are going well. I mean, they've got this £80 million cost synergy target, which they think they're going to hit a year ahead of schedule. They've already combined the management team. The kind of merger of the companies seems to be progressing well.
And demand for the gadgets that you know, does so well out of smartphones and, you know, sort of home electronics, TVs, whatever. Yeah, demand is not going away, which I guess you could also relate to the kind of whole housing boom.
Yeah, I think consumer spending has been a really strong part of the recovery, and with wages going up, that's only going to continue.
So still a buy?
Still a buy. Yeah, it's also got kind of geographic expansion on the horizon.
They've got this deal with Sprint, which should let it tap into the recovering US economy.
Yeah, yeah. Great. Okay. Dixon's Carphone.
Yeah.
Still good. Still good. While we're on the housing front, let's talk Mitchell Marsh, which is a small-ish company. It's a brick maker.
It's a brick maker, yeah.
But I love this little story because we've been following this for some time, and it's really, you know, symptomatic of exactly what's happening in the house building sector, which incidentally is the sector focus this week. We think there's a lot more to come there. But let's talk Mitchell Marsh because it's a funny little company, but I love the story. It's so old fashioned.
Yeah, it's one of those investment stories you can just understand quite easily, right? And there's more bricks, and strong demand for bricks allowed them to increase their prices by 9% over the period. So, yeah, they're doing well. Their shares actually went down on the announcement because I think they said that the second half was going to be a bit slower from the first half. The first half of the year was incredibly busy. So, we welcome that in terms of returns, well, kind of some kind of stability at least.
Okay.
And there was another a company that reported today, Breedon Aggregates, kind of building materials supplier.
Yep.
They've also done very well. And it was interesting, actually, the ONS in the first quarter thought that construction actually slowed down. And in the Breedon Aggregates results, they talk about the construction industry actually challenged that. And the ONS, I think, has slightly revised its figures. And actually, in the first quarter, construction was about flat.
That's very unusual.
Yeah, so actually, that kind of like the vaunted kind of construction slowdown ahead of the election perhaps didn't really exist, or not to the extent who people thought, and that seems to be reflected in the numbers of the companies that are exposed to construction.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's one of those scuttlebutt stories. You've only got to drive around the country, and I found myself stuck in South Essex the other day going the wrong way. And, you know, I mean, the amount of house building sites, and, you know, near me as well. I mean, just everywhere, every bit of land that they can build on, they're building on
it. Yeah, so. And if you look at Secure Trust Bank this week, which is in the results section too, the massive growth in its real estate finance, where it lends to residential commercial developers, has been huge. I mean, it's gone from basically nothing to quite a large amount of lending there. So, yeah, it's quite clear that there's a lot going on.
Yeah, I mean, actually, it was interesting. We had a couple of the alternative banks, alternative lenders, reporting. Arbuthnot and Secure, which Arbuthnot owns a very large stake in.
Yeah, 52%.
Both doing well.
Yeah, both doing well, and Arbuthnot this time having something to shout about itself as well, apart from just its massively decently performing stake in Secure Trust. Its private banking arm has been expanding, they've been hiring people, and the kind of increasing flow of profit from that has been great for the group. The Dubai office is about to kind of break even itself. So, yeah, and then obviously Secure Trust is doing really well, this massive demand for finance. And in Secure Trust, interestingly enough, is thinking of following One Savings Bank and others into the wider mortgage market, okay, especially buy-to-let, although the budget changes, they're factoring that into their thinking at the moment.
Well, that's held back the share price in Secure Trust a little bit, but Arbuthnot's kind of shielded from that slightly, albeit it has this a very large stake. Simon Thompson's read about both Arbuthnot and Secure Trust this week. And he's worked out that essentially, you know, with the stake in Secure Trust, you're essentially getting the wealth management operation of Arbuthnot for nothing in the share price at the moment, which seems crazy. These are well-run businesses in a market sweet spot. I think Simon's
famous
for his bargain shares. This is a proper bargain.
Yeah, and we have said it before as well that, you know, Arbuthnot's 52% stake in Secure Trust is worth more than Arbuthnot's market cap.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
it says it all, really.
Insane. Okay, let's quickly turn to gold, Robbo, because it's not been a good week for gold.
Well, it hasn't been a good week at all. We've seen.
Well, it's not been a good year for gold, really.
No, well, it's plodded along now at the $1,200 an ounce mark for so long, but just recently the price has come off. And earlier this week, on the back of a $2.7 billion trade in Asian markets, it hit a five-year low. Now, at the time, this was sort of conjectured. This was down to an electronic trade that had gone wrong. But sentiment isn't exactly positive at the moment. And I've seen some technical analysis today and some comments from Goldman Sachs suggesting that the price could breach the $1,000 an ounce mark.
Well, this is bad because, as we've talked about before, you know, the marginal cost of production is sort of around the $1,200 mark an ounce.
Yeah,
and you know, going below that, I mean, gold miners are simply not viable.
Well, that's right. That figure has probably come down in the interim period, as is normal with these with any commodities in this phase. But I think that the weakness at the moment is an indication, perhaps, of a euro weakness more than anything else. Because in the couple of weeks leading up to this, when the Greek crisis was at its peak, people were wondering, why hasn't gold broken out? Surely this is an ideal opportunity to buy into the metal. And you would think, on the basis of, well, yeah, it's a safe haven, why not pile in there? But actually, all the Greek crisis has done is highlighted the fact that the euro, as a single currency in its current form, may be unworkable. And recent comments from the IMF point to this as well. And so basically what you've seen is capital flows moving further towards the US dollar. And given that there's an inverse correlation between the US dollar and commodities and gold as a result, we've seen the gold price fall away quite sharply. And this applies to other commodities as well. And so in this week's article, I'm just looking at a few different aspects and looking at what might happen, for instance, if China is successful in getting the yuan accepted as one of the basket of reserve currencies around the world. You would think this would mean that eventually some of those flows that are heading towards the US would head east, and the flows that are bound for the euro would head east as well. This would ease inward pressure into the US dollar, which in a funny sort of way might actually prop up the gold price over the long run. We haven't heard anything different that all-in cash costs for gold at $1,200 an ounce. We don't think that's really changed, or if it has, it's only fallen away slightly. So over the long run, we still think that's a reasonable floor for the gold price, although market speculation at the moment suggests otherwise.
Probably not a good time to be buying gold or gold miners, though, at the moment.
Well, there's another point as well that I don't go into any particular detail in this week's piece as well, is the disconnect that exists at the moment between demand for physical gold and demand for derivative products as well. I read something the other day, and I don't know how true this is, but the actual market for physical delivery gold might actually be proportionally about 40 times as large as the underlying gold reserves, which suggests that, you know, if it came to the point where everyone suddenly turned around and said, right, we want this gold for delivery, there wouldn't be enough physical gold to match these paper assets. This suggests that there's something fundamentally wrong with the gold market, if this is true. And also, there's been I've heard a lot of anecdotal reports of the fact that people in Asia are paying well in excess of $1,200 an ounce, and have been for some time. This is private investors in Asia I'm talking about, to get hold of gold. So again, I can't verify these things, but it seems to me that there could be some manipulation in gold markets.
Yes, it wouldn't be the first time markets have been manipulated, would it now?
It wouldn't be, and you know, gold has come into for some criticism for this in the past, but we really don't know at this stage. But we think what would be interesting would be happen if the yuan is accepted as a reserve currency, which looks like it's sort of nailed on at the moment, and what indirect effect that might have on the gold price over the long run, and we think it might be positive.
Yeah, I thought maybe sentiment's also been sort of suppressed somewhat by the fact that China doesn't hold quite as much gold as people thought it did.
Well, that's according to Chinese state statistics, and they're not known for their accuracy, and there's a reason why China might be understating their reserves at the moment, even though they're trying to get accepted as a reserve currency, and that's because their export markets are linked to continued dollar strength. That's positive for them. And plus, they've got a huge US dollar exposure as well. So it actually isn't in China's interests at the moment to see the greenback fall away.
Okay. And Ian has just shown me the Nikkei story. We potentially have new owners.
We're turning Japanese. Wow. I really think so.
I knew you were going to say that.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Rob. Thank you, Robbo. Anyway, gold. Interesting. We'll keep an eye on that. We haven't really followed it for a while. It's been a bit of a damp squib of a story, but I mean, it is intriguing, if not almost impossible to understand what is going on there. Thank you for trying to shed some light on
that. Okay, John. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Before we move on to the cover feature, which Theron has written, which is about computer gaming, which is a subject which I very much enjoy, let's quickly round up the news and results. I thought the M&S story was interesting here.
Yeah, exactly right. So the general merchandise area of M&S that everyone keeps their eye on, we thought it was improving, then we found out it's not doing as well as we'd hoped, and now the head of it, John Dixon, has quit.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's fascinating because, I mean, John Dixon was the head of food for a long time, and you know, food was obviously built up into an amazing business, which really is the powerhouse in Marks and Spencer these days. I guess they hoped he could replicate that success in the general merchandise division, and he hasn't.
And now they're hoping that likely Steve Rowe, the current head of food, will take his place.
And will leave in a few years as well.
So history will repeat itself once as tragedy.
My personal view, my former colleague Julia Bradshaw's personal view, was that the general merchandise side of things, and particularly the clothing side of things, was really quite troubled at M&S. They've been through a number of management changes there. I mean, they Kate Bostock obviously was brought in to revitalise that business. Left, went to ASOS. Left there very quickly as well. You know, it's a bit of a poison chalice, this business. And yeah, you know, I don't buy much from Marks and Spencer's clothing department anymore.
Yeah, I wouldn't say I'm an expert either. But I mean, that area of the business clearly needs some kind of game changing event, doesn't it? If it's going to kind of come back to its best.
Yeah, we've not been convinced for some time. No. The share price has proved this wrong, it has to be said. My personal view would be that that's much to do with the strong performance of the food business as it has any potential recovery in the clothing and general merchandise business, which I really struggle to see what the light at the end of the tunnel here. And you know, if a man like John Dixon can't get it, you know, firing again, I wonder who can.
Yeah, exactly right. And I think, you know, trading on 17 times forward earnings. We think that's pretty fair value, given how
pretty
good.
Pretty punchy, in fact. Yeah. I mean, I'd say that's potentially beyond fair value, but.
Hold for now.
There you go. Yeah, hold for now. That's been generous. Okay, I guess that kind of wraps up everything we've got in the. I mean, there's a lot of. There's other results, obviously, but it's a bit more news. We've got some stuff on rate rises, the potential rate rise.
Things that might happen.
Greece, we probably wouldn't talk about that, so let's not. But, you know, it seems to be a story that's going away.
Further public spending cuts coming down the rails in the UK.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Really? Wow. What a surprise. Lots of interesting news there on the companies front. Okay, Theron, let's talk the cover feature. Video gaming, game on. Now, this was a sector I used to cover myself, and I've got to say, the UK video gaming industry, certainly the listed component of it, has not always had the happiest of times. You know, when I read this feature, I didn't recognise any of the names, because these were not the same video games companies that I used to cover when I was an analyst back in, you know, 2000, 2001, as a journalist in 2004-05. It's changed. And, you know, I think this is the interesting thing about this feature. The model is changing and the opportunities are different. And this is potentially a good thing for investors.
Yeah, well, I decided to write this feature because in the US, video gaming is such a big business. There are half a dozen billion-dollar companies in it, and it's a big part of the media sector. In the UK, it's not really looked at very much, and I was surprised to find there are quite a few listed companies that do give you exposure to video games the UK.
No, you said, well, I said it used to be, but I think you know, pretty much every investor that got involved in video games in the UK got their fingers burnt. Yeah. So, you know, it may be that sort of lingering antipathy towards the sector as a result of that that's part of the problem. But yeah, there's a new crop on the market, and they look interesting.
Yep, so there are a couple of major trends that they're buying into or cheerleading. One is digital distribution, where essentially when people used to buy games discs in the store, now they can download games, and video gaming has become a recurring service where the developer will sell you a game and then get you to subscribe or pay each month for more content. So it's good for consumers, maybe a bit more expensive, but it's extremely good for developers.
Absolutely. Do you know, when I first bought computer games, I used to buy them on cassette. I'd have a tape, Spectrum 48K. You all look at me like I'm mad. Actually, that's not even true. The first time I ever played a computer game, I typed it into the computer from a magazine, the code into a magazine. I'm showing my age, aren't I?
I'm the Nintendo 64 GoldenEye generation.
Right, okay. Yeah.
Classic era for gaming.
Not the ZX81 type your own game into the machine from a magazine article. It would never work. There was always one typo. You think a typo in the Bestest Chronicle is bad. Imagine typing in 10,000 lines of code and there's a typo. It did just happen. The cassette loading was also quite interesting. It used to take about 10 minutes to load a game.
Times have changed.
Anyway, yes, so gaming. Digital distribution. So you can download your games very quickly.
The rise of mobile gaming. We used to have to use Game Boys to play games on the move. Now everyone has a smartphone or a tablet and they can play Angry Birds, Candy Crush, Clash of Clans. And that's become a billion-dollar industry and very lucrative for a lot of companies. People, our readers may know about King Digital, which listed in the US at a very high valuation and makes hundreds of millions through simple games. And charging you to play them better.
Yeah, I mean, the funny thing is I look at a lot of these mobile games, and they are kind of, you know, in terms of the game itself, it's not a million miles away from what I was actually downloading from cassettes all those years ago. I mean, it's quite interesting. But I guess, you know, you make the game that works on the platform, on the media. I mean, I was fascinated by this figure, 35 billion, the predicted size of the mobile games market in 2 years' time. But it's just absolutely vast.
Yeah, and in fact, it's Apple and Google who have a lot of exposure because they run the app stores where all their games are downloaded from.
Yeah, absolutely.
And two-thirds of the top 100 apps are games. So people love them, and they're very popular playing on your commute or at home or with the family even.
Yeah, well, no, I bought my kids' mobile phones last for their birthday, and I can't get them off them. They're always playing games. What a mistake that was. Okay, so yeah, mobile, interesting trend there. What do we have any UK companies that are exposed to the mobile trend specifically?
Well, not purely. So there are a couple companies that do a mix, including mobile. So Frontier Developments, which is, from what I can tell, the only sort of pure play video game developer that's listed in the UK. It makes mobile games, and it's also started self-publishing games, so it can take all the profits rather than working through a a big video game company to get its games onto shelves. Because of digital distribution, it can now sell them directly.
Doesn't have to go through the App Store or the Android store, whatever it is, to get those onto people's phones.
Well, it can sell them through its own website, and also but to expand its reach, it is using the App Stores and various distribution platforms. But that tends to be much cheaper than having a middleman between you and the retailer.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting. Okay. The other trend that you talk about, which I think is absolutely fascinating, is the rise of gaming as a spectator sport.
Yeah.
You know, this is incredible. And there is a company in the UK that's involved in this. I actually had a reader who contacted me several times talking about this company, Gfinity, because he thought it was really interesting. And you know, we finally got there. Tell us what it's doing, because I think this is amazing. And some of the big guys are involved in this as well.
So even myself, a couple of years ago, I didn't really buy this as a trend that people were actually passionate and interested in watching other people play video games. But then you had Amazon buying Twitch, which it's the third highest source of internet traffic in the US.
That is just extraordinary.
So millions, hundreds of millions of people each month are watching video games on this platform. And Gfinity is a UK play on that. It organizes these tournaments where hundreds of people will go. They have a deal with Vue Cinemas. They've repurposed a 600-seat section of their Fulham Broadway multiplex, and it's a 25-week championship, and all these gamers compete for a big prize pool, and hundreds of people are watching there, and millions around the world are tuning in.
Wow.
So it's supposed to be $1 billion industry within 3 years.
So is it profitable for Gfinity, or are they, you know, still waiting to hit that cusp, as it were?
It's not profitable yet, but they're focusing on building a reputation for quality and drumming up interest because it's such a young industry, which I think is fair at this point.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in terms of being a young industry, I mean, you know, I thought it was a young industry when I was loading games off a cassette. But I mean, it's still a young industry. There is still a long way to go. You talk in the future about things like virtual reality, which, you know, that's becoming a reality.
Yeah, so Facebook bought Oculus, which was kind of an outsider that no one really knew what it was up to, if it could really work. And Facebook purchasing it, saying that virtual reality would not only be relevant to gaming, but for education and sports. You could feel like you're in the on the sports pitch with the players, maybe, or have ringside seats to the basketball, or in a lecture theatre. Facebook sees virtual reality as the next step in social interaction.
Yeah, so it's really interesting because, I mean, you look at sort of a lot of the sort of production in some of the special effects-driven films now, you've got to think that a lot of that's come from computer game work as well. I mean, you can see a lot of this stuff, certainly virtual reality, that must got, you know, that's got to make its way into sports viewing, you know, proper sports viewing, not gaming viewing. Yeah. this is a fascinating industry. Often leads the way. There are players in the UK that really let us access this amazing trend. OMG, talking to special effects, being a company that's heavily involved in that side of things, motion capture, that kind of stuff. You've got, you know, film stars who are getting involved in the production of video games too.
Kevin Spacey was in the latest Call of Duty.
Was he?
Yeah.
Wow.
He gets around. And there's also Keyword Studios, which is involved in the technical side of recording audio and localizing video games. And we've got Pinewood Studios, it provides production facilities and stages for TV and film, and it sees video games as another growth market.
Yeah, well, I mean, as we say, they're sort of blending. You know, we know that video games has become a bigger industry than film, if the stats are to be believed. But yeah, I mean, you know, so much crossover there. It's fascinating. Thank you very much, Theron. Okay, Algernon.
Hello.
Hello. Thank you for joining us eventually.
Pleasure.
How are you today?
Yeah, I'm very well.
We rarely get the chance to have you in the studio. So it's a pleasure to have you here.
Well, yeah, it's a pleasure to be here.
And we're going to talk stock screens.
Yes.
So let's start with this week's stock screen, which I think is an interesting one because it's very on trend, as it were.
Yeah, it's very, and I've updated it. This is because I had my big reliable screen a couple of weeks ago, which has done very well. And this one, the Safe Yield screen, which is fitting with what they're calling the bondification theme.
Yeah, well, you mentioned bondification as well, didn't you, Ian? And yeah. I mentioned it too.
Yeah, I don't know who mentioned it first.
You mentioned it first. Okay. I nicked it off you.
I nicked it off someone too. So
you probably nicked it off Algy. But yeah, go on. Well, so Algy, tell us what is this bondification?
Then? Well, it's basically the idea is people who would normally invest in bonds can't get the yields that they want from bonds, so they're looking to equities and they're looking to safe, reliable equities. What people are worried about is, I mean, these stocks, they are expensive by historic standards, but people are worried that when the bond market goes, which, you know, it's very expensive, so you imagine it would do at one point, these stocks have become correlated with it, so the stocks will go as well.
Mm.
Whereas there's also an argument that if people are moving into bonds now, I mean, moving into equities from bonds now, they'll just do it more if the bond market starts to go down. So, I mean, you know, it's one of these trends which is established. Who knows how long it will play out for, I think.
Okay,
but it's definitely been benefiting these kind of screens.
Yeah, I was going to say, so this safe yield screen,
yeah,
has delivered a fantastic performance.
Yeah,
and you've got to think that this has been driven by this shift into high yield equities.
I'd say, yeah, definite factor in it. And I mean, also with this screen, I mean, one of the reasons why you'd have to say it's a factor is because it's increasingly hard to find shares which fit the criteria. There's, you know, because there's a yield criteria, which is the valuation criteria.
Mm.
You're, you know, looking for stocks which are kind of reasonably priced on one measure. And it's, I've had to, well, for the second year in a row, I've had to kind of relax the criteria to get results from the screen.
Yeah, okay, but it's been a good one. It's a total return of 26% over the last 12 months against 5% from the All Share.
Yeah, yeah.
So no, it's working.
I mean, yeah, it's doing very well. And I mean, on a long-term basis, the first one I ran, I mean, I'd regard this as a buy and hold screen because you're looking for quality, reliable stocks. And the first one I did in 2011, those shares are up 120%, or they produced a 120% total return, and the market's just a bit less than 40%. So I mean, it's, you know, it's been a great screen. It's outperformed every portfolio, has outperformed the market. I think it's been effective at targeting the kind of theme that I was hoping it would pick up on.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, I mean, let's sort of widen this discussion about stock screens, because, you know, turning to the results of this, and I'm not going to go through all in detail, it's not entirely relevant right now, but one of them, BBA Aviation.
Yes,
that's,
yeah,
a sell tip in this
that's
week's
a sell tip in this magazine.
Now, yeah. Now, I mean, this kind of tells us something interesting about what we are doing with stock screening, in that it's a very mechanical process,
yeah,
without any kind of qualitative judgment around the shares. This is sometimes that creates a bit of confusion. How can you, yes, say that's a buy on the stock screen, but a sell elsewhere in the magazine? Yeah. Let's talk through, you know, how stock screens work. We've never really done it on this podcast, but I kind of think it's important to talk about the mechanical nature of what we're doing here.
Yeah, no, I mean, the way they work is it's simply the screen is simply looking for stocks which meet several criteria. The way I try and design them is to create a kind of style, an investment or recognizable investment style from each of the screens. And often they're kind of guru screens. So famous fund managers have, you know, written books and told people how they do it. And so they kind of, so some of the screens try and replicate those kind of processes. But they're styles which should be successful over the long term. You know, short term screens fluctuate. There's no qualitative side to it at all, which you know, arguably is the strength of a screen as well as its weakness, because stock tipping is, you know, it's hard work, and it's easy to be caught out, tip something, and you may have, you know, be looking at a stock from one angle, whereas the market's going to pick up on another angle in the story and,
yeah,
from the fundamentals.
Or your cognitive biases come into play as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I mean, also on that kind of behavioural finance point, I mean, there are psychologists who believe that, you know, complex decision making is best made using simple formulas, which, you know, which will produce better outcomes than experts like ourselves actually sitting down looking through. I mean, you know, you really what you want to do is have a process, I think. I mean, that's that in terms of the kind of practical, you know, knowledge we have of the market, or experience most of us have of the market. It's important to have a process and be, yeah, looking at valuation. And then and then from that, you can come on to, right, let's see where the story is going. Is this a reliable, believable story that I seem to be seeing? So, I mean, you know, the two fit together, basically.
Yeah, I mean, this was, so you're tips editor now. You took that,
yes,
over.
Yeah.
I mean, and you were doing the stock screens before that. And yeah,
yes.
Being the enlightened editor that I am, I thought, yeah, it would be perfect to put those two together, to have that valuation framework that a stock screen brings you, with the qualitative judgment of guys that spend their whole days looking at markets and,
yeah,
companies. And I think it's very interesting to combine the two.
I mean, yeah, we try and marry them. I mean, there's a sheet of I don't know how many ratios are on it, probably about 30 or something, which I go through each time someone suggests a tip. And I mean, the important thing though with valuation criteria to remember is things move in and out of style. So there's no point in saying I only want to invest in shares with a, you know, P of 5 or less or something like, you know, you've got to look for the story that the numbers are telling and then check that the story actually exists in terms of the company and the news it's reporting.
And that's bringing the sentiment into play, the general market sentiment, which is what the human beings are here to do,
yes,
as it were.
No, it's the sentiment and just those kind of judgments about the reliability of the business. Is this all it's cracked up to be? You need to have a lot of knowledge and experience to be able to have a chance at answering that.
That's good. So we're not going to get replaced by robots for a while. Yeah, then. Hopefully. Okay, this has been a particularly good screen over the last few years, Save Fuel Chairs. Is it the best one? Because I know we've got loads of styles. did you bring your spreadsheet with you?
I've got my big spreadsheet.
What's the best one? What's that?
So the best one I'm actually updating for the next week's magazine. It's the contrarian, it's a kind of price to sales screen. I published the 20 shares which fit the criteria, but I concentrate on the top five. So it's the top five shares which have, and this is up to date, they've since I first ran the screen in July 2011, they've delivered a total return of 205.2%, and the market has delivered a total return of 39.5%.
Not too shabby.
So, well, yeah, you made three times your money if you actually... And also, actually, because I've been through the figures, if you actually just bought the first lot of shares in 2011, you would have made a better return than that, a 220% total return.
Extraordinary.
It is. I mean, you know, and part of it's luck, because, I mean, you know, always with, you know... It's kind of whether people have been latching onto this kind of story because everything's been recovering, and that price to sales is a really great way to look for recovery stocks. So it's the sentiment's been right, and the right stocks have come into the screen when I've screened it, which, you know, happens to be it's July once a year. So yeah, you can't, you know, it's kind of, you know, it's an extreme performance, but I mean, it's hopefully it suggests the screens have long-term value. They're good numbers anyway.
Yeah, well, I don't see many weeks where the screens don't seem to be working, so yeah. I know how much hard work we often get asked, tell us how to do this ourselves from our readers, but the reality is we spend a lot of money on data.
Yeah.
And I know you've invested the money you've invested the time in building the spreadsheets that power this stuff. It's not as straightforward as it may seem.
No, and data's notoriously kind of, you know, unreliable and hard to process. So yeah, there's lots of cleaning up and interpreting of the data that we have.
Yeah, brilliant. Yeah. All right, well done, Algy. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And thank you, everyone else, Ian and Theron and Dom over there in the control room and Robbo's gone. But thank you, everyone else, for your contributions today. It's a good issue. I really like the cover feature. I think we've got lots of fascinating stories in there. As I said, we've got the sector focus is worth a read, just to reiterate that house building story, which we feel has plenty of room left to run. James Norrington, who looks after our sort of statistical portfolio and market tactics type stuff, has done a big piece on managing risk this week. It's sort of mathematically interesting but also practical. There are an increasing number of tools out there that can let you really get to grips with the risk that's inherent in your portfolio and minimise it. The usual results, they're going to pick up again next week, aren't they? And it's going to start to get busy.
It's going to be huge next week.
Oh,
it's all going on.
Wednesday looks terrible.
It's going to be a great week.
Yeah.
So you can read all about it in the Nikkei Chronicle.
Yeah, so now who we got next week? Just let's have a look. Who we got next week?
Got Sky on Wednesday.
Sky, Barclays, British American Tobacco, International Personal Finance, GSK, yeah. Oh dear. Okay, so we're all going to need a holiday once the summer holidays are finished. Okay, but anyway, thank you for listening again. And pick up the magazine this week. It's got a game that looks like it's straight out of my era on the cover. £4.50, all good news agents, and see you again soon. Bye-bye.